Right, we're continuing in our study on Lex Rex, The Law is King. And last time we introduced Samuel Rutherford and placed his book in its historical context. And then we looked at the first three questions, where he established the fact that the Bible shows government to be essential to God's kingdom purposes. And God had planned and ordained it. This wasn't an afterthought to God that he introduced at some point down the road, where he realized, oh, I need some other plan to help sort out the problem on the earth. Government was ordained and instituted by God to serve as the means by which he advances his kingdom purposes on the earth. Then in question 4 of his book, he deals with something that is central to his whole understanding of government and authority. And the question itself that we will answer in this section is, so each section in his book, he starts off with a question, and he then addresses that question and brings his answer to it. He's dealing with a main opponent, but it's really also a body of opposition to his position. And so he's dealing with a question. Question number 4 is whether the king be only and immediately from God and not from the people. Okay, who gives the king authority? How does he originate? Where does he come from? What is the basis for him being king? So when someone becomes a king or president for that matter, does he obtain his authority to rule only and immediately from God? Or do the people whom he rules over also have a hand in conveying this authority to him? And this is a critical question. From whence comes this ruler's authority? The royalists, which are the people that Rutherford was opposing, they were the ones who gave supreme authority to the king. They claimed that every specific king, so whether it's John the First or Charles or whatever it is, this particular king who's sitting in office now, he was appointed by God alone, and people had no say in granting authority to him, and therefore the king ruled with an absolute authority. If God chose him, independent of you people, and placed him in this position of authority, independent of you, who are you to challenge anything from the king? That's the royalist position in its absolute sense. No one could challenge the king's authority or his laws, because no one but God had granted him this position of authority. So that's really where the whole fulcrum swings with respect to Rutherford's position as opposed to the royalists. The royalists equated the origin and the ordaining of the office with the individual who assumed the office, whereas Rutherford was very careful to distinguish between them and assign to each the office as ordained by God and the person who filled the office. He distinguished between them. The royalists tended to just put them in the same camp and hold them together. So in answering question number 4, Rutherford says, the question is whether the king's office itself is from God. I conceive it is. But then he adds that it also flows from the people. Okay, so it's definitely from God. However, it also flows from the people. But then he makes a clarification about what he understands by this office flowing from the people. He says, not by formal institution, as if the people had an act of reason, by an act of reason, devised and excogitated a power to think up and devise it themselves, as if they defined it and established it themselves. Rather, God ordained the power, the institution of the office, that is. It is from the people only by a virtue of emanation, in respect that a community having no government at all may obtain a king or appoint an aristocracy. So Rutherford says that this question, number 4, has to do with the origin of the office, but about the specific person who fills the office, that's what he's dealing with. We're not talking about how the office originated. That's God. He ordained it. He set it up. He, from all eternity, ordained the office of a king or a parliament or whatever you want to put in that place. He says what we're discussing now is, where does the authority of the specific king we're talking about, where did he obtain his right to rule? Okay, that's what he's dealing with in question number 4. So he's not dealing with the origin, but the specific person in the office. So he says, the question is concerning the designation of the person. Whence is it this man rather than that man? Which one is crowned king? Not that man, but this man is crowned king. How does he get that? whence does it come from? From God immediately and only, that this man rather than that man is chosen for the crown? Or is it that the people also, and they're according to their free choice? And as an illustration, Rutherford says, the pastor's office is from Christ alone. Nobody came up with that idea but Christ. He said, this is the office. But that John, rather than Thomas, be the pastor is from the will and choice of men, the presbyters or the elders and the people. So Rutherford holds to those two positions as well. So Rutherford makes a clear distinction between the institution of the office and the filling of the office in a particular community. And secondly, he continues to clarify question four by saying that the designation of royal power resides in the people in three ways. Okay, this is what it is. He's saying the people are giving to this specific king this authority and this position. And this designation or delegation of authority to the king resides in the people in three ways. First, he says radically and virtually, meaning in essence and almost entirely it resides, it's in them, that's where it is. Okay, and he'll come back to that. So that's the first thing, it's in them. They have it as individuals that make up the community, they have this authority. Secondly, by way of free donation, they give it to this man, not to that man, that he may rule over them. Okay, so they picked out, I'm going to give it to John, not to Tom. And we're going to give this authority to him. And thirdly, they're giving it so as these three acts remain with the people. Okay, so they're giving it, but all these things still remain with the people. In other words, when the people give power to the king, this is how they give it. And then he wants to clarify it. So he says, okay, so you've got firstly, it's in essence, it's in them. Secondly, by way of free donation, they are giving it to this man and not to that man. So they're choosing, they're selecting themselves. And thirdly, he's going to give now another 3 points. They give it in this kind of way. One, that they may measure it out by ounce weights, so much royal power and no more and no less. So they measure out in small amounts, specific amounts. We're going to give you this much. This is what we're giving you authority to do. So they're measuring it out. The people are measuring it out under God. Secondly, they're giving it in this way, so as they may limit, moderate, and set banks and marches to the exercise. Okay, we're setting parameters and boundaries for you. And thirdly, that it may give it out conditioned or upon this and that condition, that they may take it again to themselves what they have given out upon condition, if the condition is violated. So they're giving the power. You see, the royalist, you know, he wants, once a king is a king, he's got this authority and this power, and that's his forever. Rather than saying, no, the people have the authority, but once they've given it, it's given on these three things that we've just covered. It's by measure, and it's set the boundaries and the parameters, and it's on condition. It's conditions that you meet these requirements or that is removed from you. Obviously, Rutherford is going to unpack these in more detail as we go through the book, but section 4 is critical to him laying down the foundation as to him saying the origin and the basis for authority. Talking about this innate power within the individual to delegate authority to the king, Rutherford's first point that he made, he supports by saying, the first I conceive is clear, because if all living creatures have radically in them a power of self-preservation to defend themselves from violence, as we see lions have paws, some beasts have horns, some claws, this is his analogy from nature, men being reasonable creatures, united in society, must have power in a more reasonable and honorable way to put this power of warding off violence in the hands of one or more rulers to defend themselves by magistrates. Okay, so as a lion defends himself with his claws, he's saying people, reasonable creatures, they have the authority to set up others to defend and make sure that there's peace and order. Secondly, he says, yeah, I'm going to try and simplify Rutherford's words, which are clumsy in his second point. Clumsy to our ears, that is, I'm qualifying. He says, with respect to civil power, everyone is born on the same footing. No one is born with a scepter. No one is born with a crown on their head. He says, this is a self-given fact. Okay, this doesn't happen. Thus, Rutherford argues, the authority given to a king resides collectively in the people. It resides in the united society. But that doesn't mean that they are all formal kings. I'm not giving the king authority because I myself am a king. I have authority that together in this corporate body grants authority to a king, but the authority I have in and of myself doesn't make me a king, otherwise we're all kings. We're all over each other and we're all under each other, and that's chaos. So men can give, because neither man nor community of men can give that which they neither have formally nor virtually in them. The community can't give to a king what it doesn't formally have in the first place. So the reason we can make a king is because we have that innate authority that God has placed there in order to do this. And thirdly, royalists cannot deny that cities have power to choose and create inferior magistrates. Therefore, many cities united have power to create a higher ruler. For royal power is but the united and superlative power of inferior judges in one greater judge whom they all call a king. So we realize as we're reading Rutherford, he's constantly debating the issues of his day, where the people who argued against him said, we can't make a king. Nobody makes a king. But we can make lower magistrates. We have authority to do that. And Rutherford is saying, but that is inconsistent, because all you're doing as individual people in making a lower magistrate is setting up somebody over you with authority to govern and judge you. And so why couldn't a number of these magistrates or princes set up and make an emperor? Why couldn't they do that? He's saying it's you grant the one and you refuse the other. He's saying it's inconsistent. So Rutherford says, this is the conclusion to these points I've laid out. The power of creating a man a king is from the people. So in line with the Reformed understanding of God's sovereignty and human responsibility, Rutherford shows how this applies to the electing of kings. He said, God is the first agent in all acts of the creature. Okay, so he's going to the first cause. The Westminster Confession talks about the first cause, and that doesn't undermine the second cause. God is absolutely sovereign over all things, but the human is still responsible for what he's doing. God holds him accountable. So God is the first agent in all the acts of the creature. When a people make choice of a man to be their king, the states do no other thing. The states would be now more your city states. So the people have chosen, the city state is the representative of the people, and they're going to do the same thing. So he's using those the state argument and authority at that point. Would do no other thing under God but create this man rather than another man to make him king. And we cannot here find two actions, one of God and another of the people. But it's one and the same action. God, by the people's free suffrages and voice, creates such a man king, passing by many thousands. So overlooking many thousands and choosing this man, but he does that through the people. And the people are not passive in the action, because by the authoritative choice of the states, the man is made, this man who's a private man and no king, he is made a public person and crowned a king. So he was nothing, and now suddenly he's the king. Who was he beforehand? Now he's the king. And the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule thou over us, Judges 9:6. The men of Shechem made Abimelech king, Judges 11:8 and 11, and 2 Kings 14. The people made Azariah king in 1 Samuel 12 and 2 Chronicles 23. So they were always, the scriptures over and over again show this involvement with the people actually bringing somebody or granting the authority to the king to rule. So Rutherford continues, if God doth regulate his people in making this man king, not that man, then he thereby insinuates that the people have a power to make this man king and not that man. Rutherford goes on, he says, God doth regulate his people in making a king, therefore the people have a power to make this man king and not that man king. And he says, this should be clear, because God's law does not regulate a mere nothing or an unlawful power. God doesn't regulate something that is immoral, does he? He says, well, when you're committing adultery, let me regulate that for you. He just condemns it and outlaws it. He doesn't regulate immoral things. That's why you have the issue with slavery. It's not immoral in and of itself, because God regulated it. So you have to bring it back and say, okay, there are forms of slavery that become immoral, but slavery in and of itself is not immoral. Otherwise, God would have just forbade it. He would have just said, get rid of this. This is nonsense. So in the same way, God is saying, God regulated the ordaining of kings. Why? Because it was a moral thing to do, something that God had ordained. So the Lord sets down rules and ways He doesn't set out how you shouldn't commit treason. He doesn't go through a whole list and say, well, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that and you shouldn't do that with respect to treason. He just commands loyalty and forbids it. So Rutherford then shows how the choosing of kings differed from the choosing of prophets. He said the prophets were immediately called of God to be prophets, whether the people consented that they should be prophets or not. Therefore God immediately and only sent the prophets, not the people. Though God extraordinarily designed some men to be kings and ordained them by his prophets. Okay, so he does select. Rutherford's not arguing against it, he does choose the king. And he even sends his prophets, whom he raised up without the consent of the people, to anoint these men as kings. Nevertheless, Rutherford argues, they were never actually installed kings till the people made them kings. And that's his point. This is absolutely critical to Rutherford's argument, until the people committed themselves to that and acknowledged them as kings. And Rutherford says, I prove this assumption, Deuteronomy 17, 14 and 15. And you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it, and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Yes, he's regulating. This is who it's going to be. This is how you're going to do it. This is what the standard is like. Should not this be an unjust charge to the people? He says, arguing against royalists. This will be an unjust charge if God only, without any action of the people, should immediately set a king over them. Might not the people reply, we have no power at all to set a king over ourselves, more than we have power to make Isaiah a prophet? To what end then should God mock us and say, make a brother and not a stranger king over you? How on earth can we have any say in this? God is doing it. So Rutherford is using that to argue against the false assumption that God acts immediately and independently of the people. Rutherford continues on number 3 on page 7. That's just in case somebody's following me in the book. And says, expressly, Scripture says that the people made the king, though under God, 1 Samuel 11:15, and all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord. 2 Kings 10:5, we will not make any king. Okay, so this has been an irrational speech from Jehu. He said, we're not going to make any king. I refuse to do that. And so Rutherford says, this would be irrational from Jehu and the people if they held to the royalist tenet that the people had no power to make a king, nor any active or causative influence therein, but that God immediately made the king. 1 Chronicles 12:38. All these came with a perfect heart to make David king in Hebron, and all the rest were of one heart to make David king. And Rutherford argues that nations are supposed to elect their leaders in the same way today, and he quotes another writer speaking about this text of David being elected by the people, who says, now this day God by an immediate oracle from heaven appointeth the king, the office of a king, but I am sure he doth not immediately design the man, but doth make a mark on him, and make that mark out to the people, as one who hath the most royal endowments, and the due qualifications required, and a lawful magistrate by the word of God. According to, for example, Exodus 18:21, men of truth, hating covetousness. There God's laying out. This is the kind of leaders you are to have over you. Deuteronomy 1:16 and 17 as well. Men who will judge causes betwixt their brethren righteously without respect of persons. It's another characteristic of a good judge and leader. 1 Samuel 10:21. Saul was chosen out of the tribes according to the law of God, which was in line with Deuteronomy 17, that they might choose not to choose a stranger. And Samuel judged the voices of the people, so essential to make a king. But Samuel, remember, he went to anoint Saul, and he acknowledged him formally as king. This is the king. This is the one God has chosen. God says, this is the one I've chosen. Samuel acknowledges him as the one God has chosen, and yet only as the king to be, even though he had anointed him. He never treated him as, you are the king. He waited on that. He honored him because he was to become king. 1 Samuel 9:23 and 24. Because first of all, Samuel in 1 Samuel 3:20 caused all the tribes of Israel to stand before the Lord, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken. The law provided one of their own, not a stranger, to reign over them. And because some of the states of Parliament did not choose him at that time. Okay, there was an election that went on at that time. The people accepted him, but not everybody. Samuel anointed him as king and declared him to be king. Only later on, after Saul had won a great victory over the Ammonites, that the affections of the people now turned to him in great multitudes. And then again Samuel brought the people together and they again elected him. And now it was a greater majority vote where they elected him again and put their support behind him. And he was once again chosen by the people and renewed at Gilgal his authority and his kingship, because the people had chosen him to establish him to be king. So although the Lord by lots found out the tribe of Benjamin, and the Lord found out by man, found out the man by name. Remember, God chooses him, Saul, the son of Kish. When he hid himself amongst the stuff, he said, "There he is. This is the one I'm looking for. Bring him out." That the people might be part in the creating of the king. And even though Samuel had anointed him before, so despite all God's hand in this, leading Samuel, this is the man Samuel anointing him, it's all God's stuff, this is God's identified him, God's showed everybody where it is, still it comes to the people, and the people then commit themselves to him, and at that point he is declared king. Not before. Not at any stage before. And this is critical in Rutherford's argument, I believe it's critical in the biblical position. So, despite all that God had done, Rutherford argues, the text saith expressly that the people made Saul king. And he says, and Calvin, and then he names a number of other people, do all hence conclude that the people under God made the king. Okay, it might be an obviously obvious point to you, but this is critical to Rutherford's argument, and this is really the seedbed to how he's going to unpack and defend his position later on. Rutherford continues, he says, there is now no voice from heaven, no immediately inspired prophets such as Samuel and Elisha to anoint David, not Eliab, Solomon, not Adonijah. Okay, why did we choose Solomon, not Adonijah? Why David and not Eliab, his much better looking brother, mightier man in appearance? Rutherford continues his argument by saying that since we no longer have God's divine word coming and telling us exactly who has been chosen by him to be king, since the royalists argue that the people have no say in electing a king, then in reality we have no legal kings in the world today. So that's, if it's God, no more prophets, no more kings. Thank you. But that, by the way, contradicts Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2, sorry. It contradicts those, because there we're talking about lawful authority. So where do they get their lawful authority from if no prophet has pointed to this particular leader? Okay, to me, it's kind of devastating, the argument. Rutherford puts it this way, saying, hence I argue, if there be no calling or title on earth, nothing in the human realm, to tie the crown to such a family or person, but only the suffrages of the people, that's the will of the people, making their voice known, then have the line of such a family and a person now no calling of God and no right to the crown, but only the suffrages of the people. And so, unless we're going to say that there be no lawful king on the earth when prophetical unction and designation to crowns are ceased, that's what we have to say. That's the natural conclusion. We cannot avoid that, which is contrary to Scripture. So Rutherford said, there is no title on earth now to tie crowns to families, to persons, but only the suffrages of the people. For first, conquest without the consent of the people is but royal robbery, as we shall see, and you'll unpack that later on. Because you can't just send a king into a nation and conquer them and say, no, he's the king, without the consent of the people. He rejects that as a legitimate authority. Secondly, he says, there's no prophetical and immediate calling to kingdoms. Okay, so we've already covered that with the prophets. The Lord's giving of regal parts is somewhat, but I hope royalists will not deny, a child, young in years and judgment, may be lawfully king. He says, okay, I'm going to hold you accountable. Are you going to deny that a one-year-old kid who suddenly inherits the throne, is he a legitimate king? Then we should let him be king. Which the royalists are going to say, no, we can't. We're going to have to put some people in power who are going to rule by... So he's basically holding their feet to the fire on these things. Therefore it remaineth only that the suffrages of the people of God is that the just title and divine calling that kings have now to their crowns. It's the suffrages of the people that grants them the authority to their crown. I presuppose they have gifts to govern from God. Okay, so we're not debating that. We're not looking at are they capable of governing, because the people who are judging according to God's truth are going to select those people that are. Thus Rutherford states, no man can be formally a lawful king without the suffrages of the people. For Samuel, after Saul, and in obedience to the Lord, anointed him, Saul remained, Rutherford argues that Saul remained a private man and no king till the people made him king and elected him. And David, anointed by the same divine authority, remained formally a subject and not a king till all Israel made him king at Hebron. And Solomon, though by God ordained and designed to be king, yet was never king until the people made him so in 1 Kings chapter 1. Therefore there flows something from the power of the people by which he who is no king now becomes a king formally and by God's lawful call, whereas before the man was no king but as touching all royal power a mere private man. And I am sure birth must be less than God's designation to a crown, as is clear. Adonijah was older than Solomon, yet God will have Solomon the younger by birth to be king and not Adonijah. Okay, so birth is not an automatic step to the crown. The people were still involved in that. Even if that was the policy of the nation, when David died and Solomon became king, it was only when the people placed him and accepted him as king that he actually received that authority in the nation of Israel. So Rutherford says, I think royalists cannot deny, but a people ruled by aristocratic magistrates may elect a king, and a king so elected is formally made a lawful king by the people's election. For if we had 6 willing and gifted to reign, what makes one a king and not the other 5? Certainly by God's disposing the people to choose this man and not another man. It cannot be said, but God giveth the kingly power immediately, and by him kings reign, that is true. The office is immediately from God, but the question now is, what is that which formally applieth the office and the royal power to this person rather than the other 5 that have been identified as possible kings? Nothing can here be dreamed of but God's inclining the hearts of the states and the people to choose this man and not that man. So that's the foundation. This is really the seedbed in my understanding of Rutherford. I could be wrong, but I see the rest of his book, this being launched in this section here, him saying this is fundamental to understand and clear up. Now he's going to qualify it, and he's going to show the boundaries and the parameters and the limitations on all the aspects. But I think we'll see that it'll come back to the seedbed here of this section and how he's laid out is where is that authority. Now you're going to, obviously when you're working that out into the specific applications in different ways, other information is going to need to be brought in, and he will unpack that for us. But if we can get our mind around that and realize that there is a fundamental aspect there to what is the source of authority. Now he's going to bring in, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I just want to qualify it in case your minds are spinning. He's still going to bring in the qualifications of, you know, people can't just make an immoral king. They can't make immoral laws. Nobody has the right to make that. I think we kind of covered that last time with natural law and seeing how it's all tied to the moral law. So we can't just make a law and say, well, I'm just going to elect this person and that's godly. But then still parameters and boundaries. Well, where are those lines? And so you can see it's a challenging subject, but it's a vital subject that we at least begin wrestling with so that we are equipped and capable of knowing how to be wise in our days. And as we know, Rutherford was writing at a time that was very tumultuous and politically hostile to his position. I guess we live in days that are pretty similar to that. And so we need to be sure on what we think and believe and start thinking where we will stand. Are there any questions or comments? Well, if there's no more comments, let's end off in prayer.